Ridgely speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Bruce Lindner, who's the executive director of Porter County Aging and Community Service Incorporated in Valparaiso. The agency is going to be helping and has been helping a lot of people in his area get signed up for the Changing Medicare program. The open enrollment period is underway right now through December 7th. We'll find out more. We'll also bring you another installment in the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And we'll also have with us Jesse Carbonda and his keynote speaker for the upcoming Hoosier Environmental Council's Greening the State House Conference next month. That's going to happen in central Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Porter County Aging and Community Service Incorporated is helping eligible seniors sign up for 2018 Medicare benefits during the open enrollment period, which ends on December 7th. Here's Bruce Lindner, who's the agency's executive director, talking about the agency, its long and important history to the community, and the importance of getting help in navigating the many changes to the 2018 health insurance program.
The agency has been around 60 years. It got started here in Valparaiso as an agency of volunteers to help people get to their doctor's appointments. So they were providing free services as volunteers, driving people around. Seniors still have that same big need today. Mm-hmm. It just has morphed into a larger organization. But driving is still, our busing is still our biggest program. It's three quarters of our budget. Employs the most of our employees. We have 17 employees, and 13 of them are related to the transportation department. Transportation, like any other program it's government-funded. Transportation doesn't pay for itself. We charge a dollar to the seniors, and people with disabilities ride for free. So if I don't get federal money, state money, and local money, we really don't have a transportation system. We're a door-to-door demand response service, so we don't drive around in a circle like they do at the V-Line here in Valparaiso or the Gary Transit, where they have a route. We literally pick you up at your door, take you to your dialysis appointment, take you back home anywhere in Porter County. We have a couple of other programs, Section 8 housing. We supervise about 350 clients in Porter County, verifying that they're eligible to receive their voucher. That program runs through NWICA. We've been doing that for a long, long time. I've only been here for 12 years of the 60, so I can't speak to all of that, but I've got a transportation director that's been here for 32 years, and I've got a chief deputy director that's been around for about 24 years. So those people know a lot more about what happened in the past. Building was donated to us by Wilbur Hutchinson about 10 years ago when he developed cancer. He was a business professor at the university, so it's nice to have a donated building. We don't have to worry about rent or paying for the building. All we have to do is kind of worry about how to maintain it. And we received a grant from the Risto Fund when she passed away. That is the proceeds of that $400,000 has been helping us with our major repairs and a renovation to the front of the building and a roof and a new driveway. So we're a pretty healthy organization. We're healthy from the standpoint that as long as the government funds come, we can do the energy assistance and we can do the SHIP program. But it's a... used to do senior meals, but we don't do those anymore. Mm-hmm. Bonner takes care of that. The Bonner trustee takes care of that in Portage. In Pines Village takes care of that here in Valparaiso. They both are able to make the hot meals and the people really want those more than the meals that are made somewhere else and then bust in there.
Right.
So
Well, it just sounds like just a lot of services that have come together over the decades here to help people out, in particular those seniors and others that don't have an opportunity or an easy way to get around. They need that help, to be sure, and that's what the agency's there to be able to help out. And obviously, this is a very important time of year as well, with Medicare open enrollment wrapping up here in December. And got to get the word out to let people know that if you need help in signing up, that you're there to help them out, right?
Yes, that's a big program for us right now. We have five certified counselors. They are all volunteers. So the number that they have people call in to the enrollment center is 464-1028, and you'll get asked to leave your message. And then one of the volunteers who is responsible that day calls you back and schedules an appointment for you. And they come in and meet with you at your time, best time frame. We have an office that's set up just for them in the building. And like you said, it's very critical at this time that the open enrollment. The one that I like that a lot of people are not aware of is the Part D assistance program, where you help people get into the right pharmacy program.
Mm-hmm.
I was totally shocked when I turned 65 4 years ago, and every year for the last 4 years I've jumped to a different program, because that program, based upon the meds that you're on, they will save you money. I was on United the first year, and then I went to Anthem, and then I went to Cigna, and then I went to Magellan, and then I went to Express Scripts. And basically, one of the things we do is, if you're spending more than $1,000 on your meds, you ought to come in and let us plug the meds that you're in to the computer, because every one of them charges a different for a pill. You can be on Benicare, a heart pill,
yeah,
and one is charging $4, one's charging $3, one's charging $1.50. You'll get a printout of what your meds for the year will be. And literally, that first year I saved $2,000. The second year, by changing, I went to save $400. And when I went to Magellan last year, I saved $200. And this year, I'm going to Express Scripts, and I'm going to save $200. So the last numbers are kind of small, but it's still $200 on my annual med bill. So I really encourage people, is if you're spending anything at all, especially if it's at least $1,000, make an appointment and come in. They're not selling you anything. There is no commission. All they do is they take a program that's on the computer already, and if you're computer savvy, you can do it yourself, but most seniors aren't. So you print it up and say, you know, here's what you can save if you, and the enrollment is done right there in the office. You go right to the computer, and they plug you in. So that's one. There's other one that a lot of people don't know about, and that's the low-income subsidy. If you're on Medicare but you don't qualify for Medicaid, so in other words, if you're a single living on $1,377, you can get a full subsidy that will pay your Part D premium. Now, that doesn't sound like much. I mean, it's $100 a month, Part D. But if you're only living on, you know, $17,000, $100 a month is a lot of money that comes back into your account, because they're not taking the Part D premium out of your Medicare,
right,
or your Social Security check.
Right.
The other one that a lot of people don't know is the Medicare Savings Program, and they can help with your Part B premium, your Part A deductible, Part B deductible, hospital deductible. And it's a simple one-page application that we help you fill it out. And once again, that's an income eligibility program. Mm-hmm. So if you're making a single person living on $1,528, you can qualify for some benefits there. If you're an individual, making $1,879, you can qualify for some other additional benefits. And those two programs are ones you never hear advertised, but they're really, a simple one-page application that our counselors can fill out and send it in. It takes a little bit of income verification so that they know, what you're dealing with.
Right.
But both of those programs can, you know, the hospital Part D deductible can be like $1,316 that if you have to go into the hospital, that you can avoid the deductible there if you're in that in income bracket. So I would suggest if you're over 65, you're low income, and you're not capable of are not into that Medicare or bracket, at least let them run the numbers on you. And if you're on any number of meds, I'd let them run the RX program on you too, and make sure that you get in the right program.
Well, that's why the opportunity that you can take right now to talk with the SHIP counselor. SHIP, by the way, is short for State Health Insurance Assistance Program, which is a program. It's free and it's completely unbiased. They're just there to counsel people that need the help and get the advice that they need to save money and get signed up for the right kind of services here. We're talking with Bruce Lindner, who's the executive director of the Porter County Aging and Community Service Incorporated office in Valparaiso about the program. And Bruce, I understand that there are a couple opportunities coming up very soon here that you can make appointments to actually come in and see a counselor. One of them is going to be there in Valparaiso on Thursday the 30th, and then another one's coming up in Portage on December 4th.
Yes. Well, we have our counselors here that make appointments all the time, but they're also going to be available at other locations as well. Once again, you'd call in on that number and tell them you want that appointment, and they'll schedule an appointment for you and meet them over there. So, the volunteers really take their job seriously, and will drive and meet the people at their convenience at another location.
So in other words, too, if they happen to be in the area, perhaps you happen to live near, or you have friends that take you near to the Banta Senior Center in Valparaiso, which is a facility that's going to be available on the 30th, or the Bonner Senior Center in Portage on the 4th of December, you can do that, too. Or just give the office there on Campbell Street in Valparaiso a call, and you can set something up anytime, right?
That's correct.
That's great. That's great. What kind of response have you gotten from folks so far that have taken advantage of talking with the counselors? You've talked about your own personal experience in saving money on your prescription medications. What have some other folks that maybe have not thought about this in the past, they've taken advantage of talking with the counselors? What kind of response have you gotten back from any of them?
Well, most of them are delighted. I mean, you get this booklet that's got 200 pages in it sent mailed to you, and you can't make heads or tails out of it if you're a senior and you're not doing this. So they'll walk them through and help them understand the different options that they have for insurance programs, insurance programs as well. They even talk to them about Medicaid. They can field any number of questions. Whether they're Medicare or Medicaid, they've been doing this for a number of years, especially Ginger, who is the coordinator for that program, and she is just unbelievable how much time she spends. And I haven't yet to find anybody that walked away and didn't feel like that the appointment was valuable and was helpful.
That's great.
The other thing, that even though the enrollment period may come and go, if somebody during the year comes up with a question, you can still call into that number and they will field those questions and they will set up appointments outside of the enrollment period to help you deal with a Medicare issue or a Medicaid issue and try to resolve whatever the problem is. And sometimes you miss the enrollment period, but you're still eligible to do something.
That's great.
If the circumstances are right, and they can file the petition, to get you the additional help that you need.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you will, Bruce, give us the phone number so people, if they're interested in getting the counseling help or have the questions, where they can call.
The phone number is 219-464-1028, and it's not going to ever be picked up by a person. That's going to always go to the voice message, and what they ask is your name and your phone number to call you back at, and that you want an appointment. So you don't need to carry on a five-minute conversation. Just give them that, and they'll call you back within 24 hours and work at setting up your appointment time that best suits your needs. I'd also like to remind people that the energy assistance program is also kicked off middle of November. And that program runs to May, but that's also an income eligibility program for anybody. So if if you're living on less than $1,500 a month and you're one person in your household, you would qualify for NIPSCO help, and it's a simple application. Now, you need to bring in some, once again, you have to bring in some right information. But there are four locations in Lake County. There's the trustee in Portage, and then our location as well. And we're already booked all the way with appointments up to January.
My gosh.
But this money is good that whole winter season. Mm-hmm. So if you're a senior struggling, it could be worth $350 to you to check in and see if you qualify for the Energy Assistance Income Program as well.
We've been talking with Bruce Linder. He's the Executive Director of Porter County Aging and Community Services Incorporated in Valparaiso, serving Porter County for decades and helping seniors on all kinds of issues. And in this particular, they're helping out now during the open enrollment period for Medicare, which is underway through December 7th. Give the center a call, and they'll be happy to help you out. Bruce, thank you for spending time to talk with us today. We appreciate it.
Nice to talk with you, Chris. Thank you.
Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
It's difficult to be poor in the USA. When you go into an apartment complex and you ask for income-based housing, you're automatically put into a category. You're automatically separated from the rest of society. They treat you differently. Even to get an application is difficult. But when you get the application and you sit down to try to write it out, there's no one to help you. My niece has special needs, and her husband went to the Portage Township because they were being evicted from their apartment. They went for help. And they didn't get any help because they didn't understand how to fill out the application. No one offered to help them. They were sitting there struggling and finally just gave up. I look at the example of housing opportunities when I filled out my application for housing. They were kind, respectful, honest, and compassionate. When I filled out my application for the food pantry in Portage, she wanted to know why my daughter didn't have a job, why I didn't have a job. You know, it wasn't enough just to answer the questions. I almost felt like we were being interrogated about our decisions in life. It was kind of a very humiliating situation because Portage does have a really nice food pantry, and you get some really nice things, but it was being abused by people who didn't really live in the area or just lying on their applications. And so because of that, now we have to go to the Portage Township, and we have to get a waiver. So my daughter and I went to the Portage Township, and because my daughter is in school full-time, and she's not working, the lady who took our application just didn't understand that. She made us feel very low. It made me kind of angry afterwards in the car. I'm like, I don't want to go to that person and ask for help because they help you, but they do it begrudgingly. Poor people are looked down upon so badly that we're just trash and that we've done something bad in our lives, or we're bad people because we've ended up in a certain situation. Well, guess what? There's a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck. I let myself get knocked down sometimes. I do. But then I have to go to myself, my inner self, my inner strength. I have to almost take myself out of my situation and really look at it. And ask myself, am I doing everything possible that I can to support myself and my children? Am I doing everything possible I can to advance my life? And I am. I'm doing everything I can. I'm not such a bad person. I just have some bad situations.
You can find more original stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. The place we find ourselves this week is different.
There are no birds, no bugs, no plants, no living creature, no rock, just ice. And it's just you and the wind. And there's still nights I have dreams where I hear that wind hitting the tent. Because it's unlike anything else I've ever heard in my life.
That's NASA astronaut Serena Onan Chancellor talking about Antarctica. How does a Hoosier born in Indianapolis and raised in West Lafayette end up in Antarctica? Well, we're about to find out. Growing up in West Lafayette in the 80s, Serena remembers always wanting to be a NASA astronaut. Her father, an engineering professor at Purdue, encouraged her and told her, in order to work for NASA, she had to become an engineer. On January 28, 1986, Serena was only 9 years old, sitting in her science classroom in the fifth grade. Like in many schools across the country, the entire class had tuned into the Space Shuttle Challenger launch.
Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
But it went horribly wrong, and the shuttle exploded on live TV and killed everyone on board. Despite witnessing this tragedy, it didn't change her mind about becoming an astronaut. And as the years passed, her interest grew. Soon after the Challenger incident, Serena's family moved to Colorado, but her memories of Indiana remained strong. Eventually, Serena made her way to Washington, D.C. for college at George Washington University, where she studied engineering. She decided to not concern herself with whether something fit the path of an astronaut or not, and instead follow her gut. This led her to start on a pre-med track, and according to her, confounded the admissions counselors of medical schools, since they weren't used to having engineers apply. But in med school, Serena learned about aerospace medicine, which allowed her to be hired by NASA in 2006 as a flight surgeon. Which, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, depending on how you look at it, doesn't mean that she performs surgeries in space.
A flight surgeon, that term is a very old term. It's taken from the military. And it doesn't mean that you're a surgeon who operates. It could be a psychiatrist or a family practitioner or even a pediatrician.
Though regular medicine for people on Earth treats a lot of the same diseases over and over again, like heart disease and diabetes, space medicine is largely uncharted territory because it deals with putting very healthy people in a very abnormal environment.
For example, putting someone on a space station in microgravity. You know, the environment in the space station is just like Earth. It's the same pressure, it's the same amount of oxygen, but there's no gravity. So what happens to the body when there's no gravity? What changes? How fast does it change? What permanent changes could it lead to?
Space physicians have to pay attention to the effects of microgravity on the body. Apparently, it can have effects on the muscles, the heart, eyes, vision, and more. After working at NASA for 3 years, getting behind-the-scenes look at how it all works as a flight surgeon, Serena found out she was selected for the 2009 astronaut class, beating the odds of NASA's 0.6% selection rate. Which brings us back to where we started, in Antarctica. Serena spent 42 days on a mission to Antarctica in 2000-2011, during the closest thing Antarctica has to summertime, which according to Serena is still around negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Serena was sent as part of a team to locate 4.5 million-year-old meteorites in the ice of Antarctica to help NASA learn more about space.
It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous place, but a place that will kill you very quickly if you're not careful. And so you learn a lot about yourself out there, what's important to you and how important family is and connecting with them. And on days where you're not able to get outside the tent because you're stuck due to bad weather, you know, what things do you do to keep yourself occupied? What's important to you? And those are a lot of the same skills that transfer over to the space station.
And that's not the only intense mission that Serena has been on already. She also lived underwater for 2 weeks in 2015, off the coast of Florida, doing aquatic research and practicing living in a strange environment. Astronauts that do this particular kind of mission are called aquanauts. Serena is currently training in Russia for her first space mission next year. Through the intensive training, she has been thinking a lot about which people she wants to influence back down on Earth while she's in space. Because as she says, everyone is watching. Serena Onan Chancellor is a Latina woman, Hoosier, doctor, engineer, aquanaut, and astronaut who has survived living in some of the harshest environments already, both Antarctica and underwater. There have only been around 350 NASA astronauts in the history of NASA, and Serena is one of them. But not only is she innovative and incredibly successful, she thinks about how to influence and inspire you, her fellow Hoosiers. So get inspired and follow those dreams. It's possible that the next Hoosier astronaut will be watching as Serena launches into space in 2018. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. As we approach Thanksgiving Day and the meal that brings families and friends together, we talk now about the Hoosier farmer and the efforts to grow the crops that in some cases become part of the big meal. Well, one of the major efforts that farmers are involved with, besides planting and harvesting the crops, is preserving the soil in which they grow it. And what are called cover crops are a very integral part of any farm's soil management plan. Why have a soil management plan? Well, that's why we have our next guest with us in the studio. Derek Schmidt is a district conservationist. He works with the USDA based out of Valparaiso. He works here in Northwest Indiana, and he's with us. Derek, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, tell people first what a district conservationist does, I guess. And you're working with, of course, the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Yes. So I work with a branch of the USDA called the Natural Resource Conservation Service. And we work with farmers and landowners on getting conservation implemented on the land. So we come up and we meet with these producers on their property and see what resource concerns they might have. It could be anything from erosion to soil quality to low production areas and things like that. And we come up with a plan with them hand in hand and we come up with ways to address those issues on their farm.
Mm-hmm. We have, of course, a lot of urban listeners and a lot of rural listeners, too. Our signal reaches down into places like southern Porter County, as well as southern Lee County, and into Newton and Jasper County. So we hit the farms out there, and so we have listeners that live out in the countryside or have family members who live out in the country, are familiar with the fact that it's very important for farms to properly manage the soil. And you mentioned it before our conversation that there is a place on the USDA website that is good information if you're not at all familiar with what soil health and management is all about, that kind of explains things. Tell, if you will, for our in particular for our urban listeners, the importance of what cover crops do to help preserve a farmer's soil. Because a lot of times you see, if you're ever traveling in the country, you'll see maybe a farmer out there, and this time of year it's mostly tilling under whatever's left of the crop from last year. If there's some stubble after the harvest, the farmer will leave it there. It's a good way to put some nutrients back in the soil. But people don't always understand why there's even an opportunity to put cover crops into the ground in the first place. What consists of cover crops?
Yeah, so cover crops are just plants they're just a crop that's planted to cover and enrich the soil. It's kind of a real generic description of a cover crop. So this could be interseeding, like a cereal rye or an annual rye grass, different types of grasses, and also different things like clovers or some of the radishes and turnips that you might see in some of the plantings. It's a very diverse array of plants, and basically those plants are selected to do a certain job on that farm. So there are different resource concerns that farmer might have, and their cover crop mix will be designed to address those specific concerns.
Mm-hmm. What when you talk about, and you mentioned a few of them there about turnips, among other things, and that certain cover crops do well in certain soils for certain, I guess, for whatever the farmer is actually going to be planting next season? Is that why certain crops are as chosen as cover crops?
Yeah, so part of it is what crop is going to follow that cover crop,
mm-hmm.
What crop we're going into. We might suggest certain species based on areas. They might have areas of compaction. They might have areas of like poor infiltration in their soils. They might just want to go down and capture residual nutrients in that soil profile and capture those in the roots and bring that up in the plant. So then that way it's staying on site,
right?
In that plant material as it breaks down, it's readily available for next year's crop.
We talk about cover crops as a way to as for soil management, but we have to go back even further back in history. And we're even going back to Roman times. About back then, the farmers, which we wouldn't realize maybe there were, but there were in Roman years. There were opportunities, and they realized the importance of being able to preserve the soil because they knew, like anybody else, at least at that, even in their era, that the soil was only going to be good for a certain number of years if you kept planting the same things over and over and over and over again. And so you look for diversity, and that's where it goes back, I know, into Roman times. But I guess we can even just go back to earlier parts of the 20th century. With the Dust Bowl in particular, we read about John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, about the Okies, the people who lost their lands. They were living in the center of the United States, the lands that were devastated by the Dust Bowl and having to find new lives and new careers elsewhere. And they had to travel out of where they had grown crops for decades. Family farms had been around for decades. It all shows that there's importance to having something to hold onto that soil, isn't it?
Yeah, nothing does that better than a living root, a living plant. And that's what a cover crop does. I mean, it can help prevent erosion, whether it's wind or water erosion. Those living covers will help that soil stay in place.
Mm-hmm.
And then also it captures the sunlight and it drives that carbon cycle for a longer period of time, which builds organic matter. Essentially, a cover crop just captures the sunlight for a longer period of time when our regular crops, our corn and soybeans are senescing and they're no longer growing. They're no longer capturing that sunlight. So we have a cover underneath that grabs that, turns that energy from the sun into carbon, and as the plant breaks down and the carbon cycle is completed, it actually builds the organic matter levels in that soil. And organic matter is super important because it helps support that soil structure. It helps retain moisture in times of in drought conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It helps infiltration because it helps the soil structure. So if it's a wet condition, it will help the water get into the soil instead of run off, which also goes into water quality issues and things like that. So a cover crop is really like a Swiss Army knife. It's a tool for soil health,
mm-hmm.
and that tool can be modified and be used in different ways to address these different concerns.
So actually, anybody driving by any farm here in Northwest Indiana may see something that's green out there on the soil. It isn't necessarily what the farmer would normally have. I mean, it's not like early plantings of soybeans or corn that's coming up through the soil. It's something else that's there for a reason. It is supposed to be there. In this case, it's helping preserve the soil for whatever crops the farmer's going to plant next time around. When we talk about the importance of cover crops, and we talk about this type of work, there are farmers all across Northwest Indiana that I guess have been considered very, very innovative in how they have used cover crops. And I know you have a number of farmers here in Northwest Indiana in particular that have picked up, I guess, a certain amount of notoriety for the type of work that they do in the types of cover crops they plant to preserve their soil. The National Wildlife Federation selected a number of people here in Northwest Indiana, many of them are in Jasper and Newton counties, as cover crop champions. What would consist of somebody being called a cover crop champion?
Well, those individuals are standout leaders. They're really pushing the curve on cover crop usage. They're even going in. Certain individuals are going above and beyond. They're they're getting cover crops in their rotation whenever they can. They look for those windows of opportunity. They integrate them and run with it. They're doing things such as even early interseeding just to see if there are other alternatives that are out there to get a growing cover for a longer period of time.
Okay. There are a number of these, and I'm going to mention some names here and some people I'm sure you know. You've had a chance to meet them, and you've had a chance to work with a lot of these people. One guy in particular who we had hoped that we'd have a chance to chat with but wasn't able to talk with us today is a fellow named Dan Perkins, and he has a farm down along the Iroquois River watershed. And he's often known regularly as the cover crop guy. And I guess that's because he's branched into the social media as well as being a farmer and actually getting out there working in his own soil, in his own farm. He's had a chance to be a good educator. Tell us about Dan.
Yeah, Dan is a great advocate for soil health. He and Jasper and Newton counties, they have come up with a soil health field day for a region. So it's a huge regional event. They just had Ray Archuleta up, and he spoke. He's a leader in education of cover crop usage, mm-hmm. and nationally known. He's really pushing for getting the information out there so producers can make decisions to improve their operation. Mm-hmm.
There's another fellow that is a good example of somebody who has innovative work with cover crops has helped to not only save his soil, but he's made a name for himself too. Mark Jordan is a fellow. He's a farmer, and he's also raises purebred beef as well too on his farm there in the Rensselaer area. But he has about 1,200 acres of corn that's out there that he grows on a regular basis, and he's been doing cover cropping for more than a decade. I'm sure you probably had a chance to work with him as well too. Are people like him where they try to come up with different ways to be able to pick different within whatever they were working with, as far as in this case corn, for their regular crop, but they kind of come up, as you say, with the right kind of cover crop to protect the soil. Do you have any other people that you're aware of that you can tell us about that you know of their example that you have had a chance to work with?
Yes. Yeah. So Mark is a producer down in Jasper and Newton County. So yeah. we do have another district conservationist down there, Kevin Scheid.
But you do get a chance to find out, you know, at least to have a chance to work with him, or you're familiar with him and all. Are there any others that, since you're working out of the Valparaiso area?
Yeah, we certainly have a lot of top-notch cover crop and soil health leaders in our area. We just had a Lake County soil health field day, mm-hmm. November the 1st. And that was at the Peterson farm. So we were out there at that farm, and we were able to promote cover crops. They were doing cover crops in following a rye. They harvested the rye for grain or for seed for seeding into their corn acres. And then they also followed that with a very diverse mixes of cover crops on site. So we were also able to hold a field tour out there, and that was all because of Bill and Kim Peterson, mm-hmm. and their farm and what they're doing out there. And it was because of Lake County Soil and Water, who is a partner with us.
That's right.
We also had a field day in Porter County. And that was up by the Heron Rookery. So we tied how cover crops are beneficial for both the land and also water quality. Mm-hmm. So we teamed up with the National Lakeshore, and they did a fish shocking and showed us the different species within the stream and how that water quality affected the species in the stream.
We've been finding out more about cover crops and how important they really are to not only the soil in which the farmers have to grow them in to preserve their soil, but the importance to the environment as well, too. And Derek Schmidt is a district conservationist with the USDA. He's based out of Valparaiso. And, Derek, thanks for spending some time with us to talk about this today.
You bet, Chris. I appreciate the time.
The 10th annual Greening the State House, which is the annual conference for the Hoosier Environmental Council, is happening soon. And the guest speaker is going to be a fellow who has had quite a life not only in the environmental issues, but also out of. And we're going to find out more about that. Reverend Mitch Hescock is going to be the main speaker for the event this year, to be held down in Danville, Indiana. And Reverend Hescock is with us here. Thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. Glad that I could be with you.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. How I understand, based on the information that the Hoosier Environmental Council has forwarded on to me, that that you started out with a life in the fossil fuel business, but that has changed dramatically, I would say. Tell us about it.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a Western Pennsylvania kid. My dad was a coal miner. My grandfathers were coal miners. And I, for the first 14 years of my working career, was in the coal industry as well. I used to design great big gigantic grinding equipment to feed coal-fired power plants, pulverized coal boilers around the world. So I know the fossil fuel industry very, very well. And then after that, I had a calling from God to become a pastor, and I pastored a church for 18 years. And then for the last 9 years or so, I've been the president of EEM, the Evangelical Environmental Network.
Mm-hmm. What did you feel that you wanted to accomplish besides your calling for in your faith to be able to bring the environmental issues into that as well, too?
Well, it's really because of my faith that I care about the environment. In fact, I don't consider myself an environmentalist. I consider myself a disciple of Jesus. And, you know, right in the beginning of the Bible, Genesis 2:15, it says that we are called to tend his creation, to tend the garden. We are only caretakers of this creation. The Psalms 24 says the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And so we're supposed to be the gardeners, the caretakers, the stewards of creation. And the thing that really led me to start caring about creation care, as we call it, is the fact that I am very much called to protect the least of these. Jesus' command in Matthew 25. And also, I'm a traditional evangelical. I love to tell the good news of Jesus and to invite people into a relationship with Jesus. And I found out that creation care is one of the strongest ways to do both. We pour so many pollutants into our environment, both in the United States and around the world, that we seriously impact the lives of our children especially and others. And also, I found out that especially among younger people who have got disillusioned with religion, especially sometimes with us evangelicals, that they have a sort of a bad taste in their mouth for faith. And when I share with them how God cares about this creation and cares about the poor and cares about the impacts of our poor creation care, that they begin a relationship with Jesus. So that's what I do, what I do. It's because I really want to be a follower of Jesus the best as I can be.
Mm-hmm. I know where you feel these days with the political climate changing as it has here with the change of the administration in January and the concerns I know that many people have about the environment because they don't see the support that environmental issues have had in past administrations, past decades for that matter. Do you see that that's where we have to get even stronger, especially in how you feel in being in charge of the Evangelical Environmental Network?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I think, you know, it's no secret that 80% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. At the same time, about the same number voted for Mitt Romney the election before, and before that even John McCain. And many of our voters tend to vote for really their largest single issue is on being pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I help our community understand is that being caring for God's creation is also a pro-life issue. Along with the National Association of Evangelicals, which I'm a board member of, and the Roman Catholic Church, and even Focus on the Family, pro-life is more than just concerning about the ending of a pregnancy. It's also concerned and should be concerned about all of life. And so we like to say, and mimicking what the NAE says, is we are pro-life from conception to natural death.
Mm.
And helping people to understand the impacts, the threats, especially on children's health from pollution, is a critical part of my message and what I do.
Now, what do you hope that you'll be able to bring to the folks who will be attending the annual Greening the State House conference in Indianapolis? These are pretty hardcore environmentalists, and I'm sure that you'll have something that will probably open up their minds, I would hope.
Well, I hope so, and I think that the two messages that I really hope to bring to Indiana and my trip there, and, you know, I've been to Indiana before. We have over 20,000 supporters in Indiana already who are taking action for part of the Evangelical Environmental Network. But my message is twofold. One is that caring about God's creation should not be a political issue. It should be an issue that everybody, all Americans, whether you're progressive or conservative, whether you're faithful or not faithful, should be concerned about. And the first part to talking to my tribe, my conservative friends, which I'm a lifelong Republican, is to really do two things, is to really to help people highlight the fact of what pollution does to our kids. You know, I think if I'm right, in Lake County, there are almost 9,000 kids that have asthma. And within 30 miles of Evanston, more pollution is put out by fossil fuel coal-fired power plants than any place else in the country. And that pollution impacts our kids. The more fine particles, the more other toxic substances, and even carbon pollution, as the earth gets warmer, really impact our kids. And I think one of the things that when driving that message home, that, you know, Indiana is the number two state percentage-wise in the country from children that die early in preterm birth from soot. Around the country, about 16,000, a little over 16,000 people, children, are born prematurely because of PM2.5, fine particles of soot. And in Indiana is the number two state percentage-wise for that pollution. People need to realize what we're doing to our kids. You know, see, South Bend is the top, I think it's the 21st top city in particle pollution in the United States.
Yeah.
Indianapolis is number 13 on year-long pollution of particles. These are real problems that people need to address that impact our children's lives. And it's something, there's over 8,000 miles of polluted water in Indiana. Many of that, some of that farm pollution and runoff, some of it's human waste, but a lot of it's mercury and PCBs that foul our water. One in three kids in the United States today have autism, ADHD, asthma, or severe allergies. And while fossil fuels aren't the only cause of it, they are certainly a contributing factor to what's called this 4A epidemic in the United States. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, more and more studies are pointing that way. Even things like breast cancer, while it's not fossil fuel-related, it's plastic-related. You know, the National Institutes of Cancer say that breast cancer is going to go up 30% by 2030 because of estrogen-mimicking hormones or chemicals that appear in plastics.
Mm-hmm.
So these are real health concerns that, you know, should wake up all of America that we have to deal with our problems. This is not a right or a left issue. It is truly an all-American issue, and for me, it's an issue of my faith.
Well, Reverend Hescock, it sounds like you're going to have a great message. Wake up some people and let them know about the concerns they may have had, but how close to one's faith that these can actually come along. Reverend Mitch Hescock is the president of the Nationwide Evangelical Environmental Network, and he's going to be the keynote speaker for this year's annual Greening the Statehouse message. Let's turn now to Jesse Carbata, who's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, to talk about the entire program for the 10th annual Greening the Statehouse event happening in central Indiana. Fill us in on, besides what Reverend Hescock is going to say in his keynoting address, is going to be covered during the event this year.
The 10th annual Greening the Statehouse is going to be very much focused on trying to keep spirits high as far as being an effective advocate. So while we'll be covering a lot of the leading issues in facing Indiana's environment, as we do during these annual public policy conferences, we're going to be spending a lot more time on tool building. How do members of the public become more effective in organizing in their communities? How do they become more effective in engaging with the media and in building coalitions? And the intent then is that for people who attend Greening the Statehouse, they will feel a sense of being empowered, not only in terms of knowledge, but in terms of skills.
You mentioned in some of the information I've had got received for you folks here, you're talking about some of the seminars. In particular, you mentioned about some skills that some of the environmental interests should have out there that maybe don't have, and that is, one of those is working with the media. And you have some very interesting people, I understand, on the panel are going to talk about how environmental groups can best use the opportunities that they will have available to them. Tell us about these folks.
Well, you know, the big picture with respect to both the media panel and the other panels is that we feel that there's a degree of jadedness that has happened because of the difficulty in making environmental progress in the state, given mm-hmm. the ideological nature of the General Assembly in general. And then, of course, things have been stymied at the federal level as well in terms of trying to make progress on improving drinking water quality, in terms of trying to tackle climate change and other big issues. And the intent for all of these different sessions is to put some of the best practitioners in the state before our supporters and attendees, and just give them a better understanding of how to be more effective at advocating within their communities. And one piece of that, which you alluded to, is how do people effectively engage the media? I think sometimes there may be the tendency to be hypercritical or to maybe go on the attack at getting angry at an elected official. And while that might feel gratifying for a few minutes, it may be counterproductive. And so we're trying to kind of impart on supporters best practices.
One of the other topics I know is going to be brought up, a very important one, a very critical one here in Indiana and in Northwest Indiana in particular, has been the problems with the lead contamination in the neighborhoods in East Chicago. And I understand that there's going to be a panel that's going to talk about that. I mean, in particular, you're going to have a representative from Northwest Indiana who's very knowledgeable and has been at the forefront of the complaints about the environmental issues up north here.
That's right. Reverend Cheryl Rivera will be on our panel called and organizing. And she'll be talking about she's a very prominent civic leader working to address the lead crisis issue in East Chicago. And she'll be certainly sharing her lessons learned about how to be effective in an urban context. And then we'll be having other panelists that will speak to how we can be effective in a rural context.
Mm-hmm. Usually you have the annual Greening the State House conference around Indianapolis, and this time you've moved out into one of the collar counties, moved out into in the area around Danville, and perhaps it would take get some time to talk about how folks who are interested in attending this year's event, have signed up for it, can get out there so they can take full advantage of all these opportunities, not only hearing Reverend Hescock speak, but also attending these panel sessions as well. To tell us how folks are going to be able to make it into the fairgrounds there in Danville to attend.
Yes. Well, we have normally held our Greening the State House event, as you said, in Indianapolis. And the good news is that we've outgrown every facility that we have been at and forecasting a bigger turnout than normal. We're out at the fairgrounds. It will be inside in an auditorium. And Danville, Indiana, is about 30 minutes west of Indianapolis, right off the highway. And, you know, again, it provides a spacious venue not only for the hundreds of people that we anticipate coming to the event to get to know one another, but also to interact with more than 20 nonprofits and green-minded businesses that share the mission of the Hoosier Environmental Council to make positive progress for the environment with a particular interest in promoting clean energy, sustainable agriculture, and 21st century forms of transportation, whether that's mass transit or passenger rail or greenways. So people that want to see a more healthier and greener Indiana would really benefit from coming here, including our friends up in Northwest Indiana.
Well, Jesse, it sounds like you have great topics to discuss and great topics to hear from, in particular when you hear the keynote address from Reverend Mitch Hescock for the event this year. We're talking about the 10th annual Greening the State House, which is Indiana's largest annual gathering of environmental-minded Hoosiers. It's going to happen this year at the Hendricks County 4-H Fairgrounds, which is west of Indianapolis in Danville. And you can always go on to the Hoosier Environmental Council website, find out more, get signed up for the events as well, too. Jesse Carbonda, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about this, and the best of luck for everybody attending the and organizing the big event on Saturday, December 2nd.
Thanks very much, Chris. Always appreciate your interest in our issues.
And Jesse Carbonda also tells us that two honorees from Northwest Indiana will be featured at the Hoosier Environmental Council's Greening the State House event next month, Dunes Action and Jeanette Naira. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We hope you'll join us for tomorrow's program.